In our study tonight, we're continuing into the 12th chapter. In the 12th chapter, I want to look at verse 1 as we begin somewhat of a new section of the study of the book. We've gone through the first 11 chapters, and we've come to the conclusion that God's people are suffering. They're being persecuted because of their faith. And the first 11 chapters of the book present to us the culmination in the 11th chapter with the victory of God's people over this persecution. In fact, we noted that in verse 15, with the sounding of the seventh angel, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And I think that's the implications of some Old Testament passages that we've looked at, particularly in Daniel 2, and then again in Daniel chapter 7. And then we are introduced again to the 24 elders in verse 16, praising God in victory regarding the victory over this persecution. Now, we've noted that beginning in the 12th chapter going forward, there is something that is behind all of the persecution of the saints, and it's something that's been going on a long, long time since the Garden of Eden. And now we're beginning to see the vision that John sees, a great sign in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. Now, we talked about that last time. We looked at verse 2, and she cried, and she was with child, and she crieth out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered. And we noted all the way back to Genesis 3, verse 15. This struggle began actually in Genesis 3, verse 15, where there would be enmity between the woman and between thy seed and her seed. And we noted that that word enmity means hostility, and that has historically been the case. This woman that's described, we wanted to note once again her appearance. We had some discussion about this last time. And we noted that she is the bearer of light, as it were. She's clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and on her head, a crown of 12 stars. And we noted then, and this become important to our study tonight as well, that the word used here for crown is the word Stephanos, which indicates a victory crown. Satan never wears such a crown in the scriptures. We're going to be talking about tonight how that he wore, a crown of diadem. But it was not a crown of victory, and we'll talk about that as our study progresses tonight. But in our study tonight, we simply want to make note of her appearance. Arkwright makes this observation, quoting from Linsky in his commentary. He said that Linsky analyzed the difference between the two types of crowns. We note that Jesus received a Stephanos of thorns, and when he was mocked as king of the Jews. Here, this woman has the 12 Shashar Stephanos, her symbol of victory. The victory ours remaineth, and thus the victor of this shall reign forever. Well, the point being is that Satan has no Stephanos. He's not a victor. Even though he has a position of royalty, and we'll talk about that more, he is not wearing a victory crown, nor will he ever wear a victory crown. But Christ does, and this woman does, and that's what's promised to you that you can have. We'll notice that as our study progresses. I want to pass beyond that. We noted in the study of the seven churches to Asia Minor, for example, in the third chapter, in the letter to the church at Philadelphia, the writer says in verse, I have it later in this series of charts, so I'll have to come across it then. But in chapter 2, in the letter to the church at Smyrna, in verse 10, there the writer says, "Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown." Here's our word, Stephanos, the crown of life, the victory crown. This woman wears this type of crown. Now, we had some discussion last time about who this woman is and who this woman is not. Let me emphatically say that this woman is not, as some identify her, as Mary. It's not a literal woman any more than the dragon identified in this chapter is a literal dragon. But from this woman comes the man-child. We see that in verse 5. We noted, or tried to, very distinctly last time that this woman is not the nation of Israel as a whole. And I think we see evidence of that further in this chapter. We'll talk about it in the 17th verse of this chapter. But the nation of Israel as a whole, they rejected Christ. It was the nation of Israel as a whole that Judas Iscariot made a covenant with to betray the Lord for 30 pieces of silver. And we see that as a matter of prophecy in Zechariah chapter 11, verses 10 through verse 13. I find it interesting as well that when Jesus came into the city of Jerusalem for the last time in Matthew chapter 23, as he spoke concerning the temple, he said, "Your temple is left unto you desolate." I think that's an emphatic statement. Because he no longer recognizes it as God's temple. So I don't believe that we can say with confidence that the woman in this passage is used to describe the nation of Israel as a whole. And furthermore, it's not the church. Simple point, the church did not give birth to the man child, but the other way around. And so that's what we want to note. Jesus said, "Upon this rock, I will build my church." Now that raises the question for clarification. Who is this woman? And I think we established the point in our last study that this woman represents God's faithful, the faithful remnant. We talked about that from Isaiah chapter 1, verses 5 through 9, that is identified in the text as the daughter of Zion. That's an interesting terminology that is used in the text to identify this woman. And perhaps it's worth our while just to go back and look in the text of Micah, coming forward just a little bit into the fifth chapter of the book of Micah from the fourth chapter. In the fourth chapter, you'll notice that the writer is describing what's to take place in the latter days. Chapter 4, verse 1, and that's the parallel of Isaiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, if you're taking notes. But in verse 6 of Micah chapter 4, it says, "In that day, saith Jehovah, will I assemble that which is lame, and I will gather that which is driven away, and that which I have afflicted, and I will make that which is lame a remnant, and that which was cast off a strong nation." That's important. Note that. "That which is cast off a strong nation, and Jehovah will reign over them in Mount Zion from henceforth even forever." Dropping down to verse 9, he continues, "Now, why dost thou cry out aloud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished, that pangs have taken hold of thee as a woman in travail? Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail, for now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and shall dwell in the field, and come even unto Babylon. There shalt thou be rescued. There will Jehovah redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. And now many nations are assembled against thee that say, let her be defiled, and let our eye see our desire upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of Jehovah, neither understand they his counsel. For he hath gathered them as the sheaves of the threshing floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion. For I will make thy horn iron, and I will make thy hooves brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many peoples, and I will devote their gain unto Jehovah, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Now shalt thou gather thyself in troops, O daughter of troops. He hath laid siege against us. They shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek. But thou, Bethlehem Ephrathah, which art little to be among the thousands of Judah, out of thee shall one come forth unto me, that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth are from old, from everlasting. Therefore will I give them up until the time that she who travaileth hath brought forth. Then the residue of his brethren shall return unto the children of Israel." Now, I'm going to stop reading there, because what I want us to note in this context is the use of the expression "daughter of Zion." It occurs over and over in this context. And we know who would bring forth this one that would eventually develop into a nation, as it were. And we see that to begin in Bethlehem Ephrathah. That's where that would all start. Now, the language we not talked about last time from Micah chapter 4 and chapter 5, and noted the similarity of the language with that which we've read in Revelation chapter 12 in the first few verses. this woman that's described as arrayed with the sun and the moon and the crown of 12 stars. Verse 2 tells us she was with child, and she crieth out, travailing in birth and in pain to be delivered. Well, Micah chapter 4 and Micah chapter 5 help us to see who this woman is at the time that John is writing. He's talking about that faithful remnant of Old Testament times brought forward then and developed into this nation of spiritual Israel, spiritual Zion, which we know of today as the church. Now, I want us to do a little thinking on the passages that we have on the screen. So stay with me on this. Go back with me to Isaiah chapter 66, and let's again do some reading. Isaiah chapter 66. I want to begin in verse 4 I have on the chart. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 4. Let me get to it. Should have put my marker there. Isaiah chapter 66. Let's look beginning at verse 4. In verse 4, the text tells us, I also will choose their delusions and will bring their fears upon them, because I called, none did answer, and when I spake, they did not hear, but they did that which was evil in mine eyes and chose that wherein I delighted not. And then he says in verse 5, hear the word of Jehovah, ye that tremble at his word. Your brethren that hate you shall cast you out for my name's sake, have said, let Jehovah be glorified, that we may see your joy. But it is they that shall be put to shame. The voice of tumult from the city, a voice from the temple, a voice of Jehovah that rendereth recompense to his enemies. Therefore she travaileth, she brought forth. Before her pain came, she was delivered of a man-child. Who hath heard such a thing? Who has seen such things? Shall a land be born in one day? Shall a nation be brought forth at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth, saith Jehovah? Shall I that cause to bring forth shut the womb, saith thy God? Rejoice ye with Jerusalem. Be glad for her. Well, we'll pause there in that reading. What I want you to see in this passage is that a nation would be brought forth in a day. It would be brought forth all of a sudden. Now, what day you suppose that was? What day was this nation began or begun?
Day of Pentecost in Acts 2.
Yeah, they have Pentecost in Acts 2. Now, I think these verses that I have on the board here are just emphatic. Stay with me in this and turn back over to the book of Hebrews. I said that this woman, this faithful remnant of Israel, wasn't the whole of Israel, but this faithful remnant of Israel, eventually then made up this, what we see after the fact, this nation that was born in the day. Turn with me, if you will, to Hebrews chapter 12, first of all, and let's do some reading. Hebrews chapter 12, and I want to pick it up in verse 22. In Hebrews chapter 12, first of all, what was the purpose of the writing of the book of Hebrews? What is the book of Hebrews? What's its nature?
Better race. Yes. Better covenant.
Our better covenant, that's true, but better occurs about 12 times in the book of Hebrews. So if you've got something that's better over here, then you've got something that it contrasts with. It's better than this over here. And that's the point. The book of Hebrews is a book of contrast. I sometimes like to emphasize it like this, that these Jews needed to see that what they have become a part of is not permanent in terms of their citizenship in the nation of Israel. That was soon to end. But what they've become a part of, as far as the church is concerned, there will be no end. They've become a part of something that's permanent. Now, why in the world would you want to leave what you had become a part of and then go back to something that's inferior, to offer inferior sacrifices, be under an inferior covenant, and all of these kind of things. Why would you want to make that change and go back to what you were? Well, the point of the Hebrew writer is, if you do that, you lose everything. Because even under the law, it don't do what it once did. There's no sacrifice under the law that would make you perfect, Hebrews chapter 10, verses 1 through 4. And so this is going to be done away, and it's not going to do what it once did. But when you come into Hebrews chapter 12, beginning at verse 22, he tells them what they had become a part of. But ye are come unto Mount Zion, and unto the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable host of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to the God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of just men made perfect. I want to pause and talk about that for just a little bit. These who've now become a part of the church, they have come to the spirits of just men made perfect. I wonder who that is. Who could that possibly be that they have joined? Well, as you'll turn back into the book of Hebrews, into the 9th chapter, look with me at verse 15 of the 9th chapter. The writer says, and for this cause, he, that is Jesus, is the mediator of a new covenant, that a death having taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant, they that have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. Now, stay with me on this. I don't want us to get lost. If you do have a question, if I need to clarify something, bring that up, because I think this passage is very important. These Hebrews are beneficiaries of the mediator of a new covenant, because now there is redemption. And you'll notice in verse 9, redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant. They that have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. Who was it that was the beneficiaries of the redemption that Christ came to offer who had lived under the first covenant?
Those in Hebrews 11.
Those of Hebrews 11. Thank you. Yes, those who are faithful, those who have kept the sacrifices, those who have served the Lord, this remnant of Israel, are those that are discussed in chapter 9, verse 15. And as you come to Hebrews chapter 11, a most impressive passage, after Hebrews chapter 11 lists a long list of Old Testament worthies, he then tells us, beginning in verse 39, that these all, having had witness borne to them through their faith, received not the promise. God, having provided some better thing concerning us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. What does that suggest to us? Now, the language is probably a little different from the way that you and I speak when we say that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. What's he suggesting to us? They'll be made perfect with us, not apart from us. Well, who were those people that would be made perfect with us? That faithful remnant who lived under that Old Testament system. They would be made perfect with us through the redemption that is offered in Christ. And I think that becomes the point that's developed a little bit further in the book of Revelation in the 12th chapter there in verse 17. Because now the woman is included as being persecuted along with the rest of her seed. That's not just talking about Jesus. That's talking about you and me. That's talking about these folks in New Testament times who were suffering persecution. They too would be tormented. Now, going back to Revelation 12, any question or comment just here? And keep in mind, I can't see all of you, so if you've got a question or comment, get my attention. Well, in verse 3, the writer continues, and there was seen another sign in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 diadems. Now, here's where we were a while ago. It says, "And his tail draweth the third part of the stars of heaven and discasts them to the earth. And the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child." Now, we don't have to wonder about who the dragon is. The Bible tells us who the dragon is down in verse 9. If you'll just turn the page and read that, it says, "The great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the deceiver, and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him." Lots to say about that, but we'll wait till we get to verse 9. Here in verse 3, notice the description of this dragon. This dragon is described as red. He's described as having seven heads. He's described as having 10 horns. Now, when we read in Old Testament text concerning this element of 10 horns, certainly this picture paints a picture that's ugly to us. But what we want to note is here is one in his appearance that is presented as mighty in power. Here is one that exercises sovereignty. But sovereignty over what? What is it that Satan rules over?
Darkness.
Well, he rules over the kingdom of darkness. That's right. You'll notice in Colossians chapter 3, Bruce, and I'm glad you used that passage. It's where I wanted to go. In Colossians chapter 3, chapter 1, verse 13 it is, the writer said that God delivered us out of the power of darkness and translated us into the kingdom of the Son of his love, in whom we have our redemption, the forgiveness of our sins. Here's a realm that's described as the realm of darkness. Satan rules there. He's described as the prince of this world in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. He's described as the god of this world in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 in verses 1 through 4. And so here we are, the passages that we had before us. Paul elaborates on that in the Ephesian letter in Ephesians chapter 4. He continues there in verse 14. Ephesians chapter 4, let me get to it, verse 14. He said that we may be no longer children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the sleight of men in craftiness after the wiles of error. Satan is wily. He's crafty. And that's how Paul presents him. You'll notice in the sixth chapter, the thought continues in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. "Finally, be strong in the Lord and the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." And then in verse 12 of that, he said, "For our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this darkness, against the spiritual host of wickedness in the heavenly places." Who are we fighting against? Well, we're fighting against the wiles of the devil. There's a realm in which he has authority. And we noted in 2 Corinthians 4, verses 1 through 4, that he's described as the god of this world. He's described as the serpent, the devil, Satan. Now, we're familiar with this passage in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8, where we're told to take heed, to beware, because Satan is described as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Now, you couple these images that we presented from Ephesians and from 2 Corinthians. We didn't look at John chapter 8. We'll do that in just a moment. And especially in 1 Peter chapter 5, we come away and we say, well, Satan is a formidable foe. There's just no way that I can overcome the prince of this world. He that rules over the realm of darkness, I can't overcome him. Now, let me ask you, brethren, what's the purpose of the writing of the book of Revelation if we can't overcome the devil? If Satan and all of his helpers, if I may use that term, has authority over Christians and Christians cannot overcome the devil, then what's the purpose of the writing of the book of Revelation? There wouldn't be any consolation to them. I want us to note what I have on the board here and just underscore this, that yes, he is referred to as the god of this world. He is described as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour, but he can't devour just any and everybody. He certainly won't what we'll call limitations and those that he can reach. You say, well, how's that, Mick? Well, let's read some again. Turn to the Hebrew letter. Read with me in Hebrews once again, chapter 2. Hebrews chapter 2, beginning in verse 14, a passage that I guess I just missed for a while. But in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14, the writer says, "Since then the children are sharers in flesh and blood, he also himself in like manner partook of the same." Now why? In verse 14, he continues, "that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver all them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage." Is there any way to overcome the devil? Can we conquer him? And why? Why do we have any hope of being able to conquer him?
Well, our hope is in Jesus.
That's right. Because Jesus did. He did.
Mickey?
Yes.
Yeah. I think this is one of the beautiful things about Revelation is that it's not about you can conquer the devil. It's I have conquered the devil. You're good to go. And so I think that it points out the fact that the devil is not more powerful than God. And we may be in a world that is completely overcome with evil and we may despair about we just can't do anything about that. We have no influence. We just can't do it. But Revelation, and as well as every place in the Bible, God is pointing out, you are not in this alone. I am here. I got it handled. Buck up, you know.
He overcame.
Yes,
exactly. And that's the point.
Yeah.
And we saw in Revelation 1, I believe it was verse 18, that the letter is from God through Christ, revealed through his angel unto the servant John. And as Jesus is identifying himself, he said, "I hold the keys of death and Hades." Well, who had held it? Who had held it? Well, Satan had. But Jesus overcame sin. He overcame temptation. He overcame death as he was raised from the dead. Now he holds the keys of death and Hades. Now, isn't that what he promised to do? In Luke's account, in the 11th chapter, in verses 21 and 22, he said, "When the strong man, fully armed, guardeth his own court, his goods are in peace. But when a stronger than he shall come upon him and overcome him, he taketh from him his whole armor wherein he trusted and divideth his spoils." Now, who's Jesus in that equation?
He's definitely the stronger man.
He's the strong man. And he overcame. And isn't that what Isaiah prophesied that he would do? This passage, again, is one that I have learned over the years, and it's in a familiar context of Isaiah chapter 53, but a point that I guess for a long time I had just overlooked until I studied some more. But in Isaiah chapter 53, look, if you will, at verse 12. This whole chapter is talking about what Jesus came, what he did. And it says at the latter part of verse 11 that he shall bear their iniquities. But look at verse 12. "Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bare the sin of many and made intercession for their transgressions." Now, we often read Isaiah chapter 53 in connection with the observance of the Lord's Supper, and rightly so, because the passage talks a great deal about his sacrifice for us. But how many of us have noticed that expression? "Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong." He shall divide the spoil. What is it that he came to do? He came to overcome. And what did he do when he overcame? What always goes to the victor? They're the spoils. That's right. Now, what did kings do with the spoils when they were the victors? They put it into their coffers, didn't they? What did Jesus do when he overcame with the spoils? He's willing to share it, to divide the spoils with the strong. Now,
so I'm sorry to interrupt, Mickey.
That's okay. Go ahead.
So my question right there, Jesus is dividing the spoils with the strong. Who are the strong in this?
The faithful. The faithful. the same faithful that we're reading about in Revelation 12, made up of the faithful of that Old Testament remnant, made up of the faithful of present age that John is addressing here in this book, and I might add to that, made up of the faithful of today's age and any future age that may be. Those are the victors that he divides the spoil with. Now, does that mean that Satan never gains a victory? Well, no, let's be careful with that, because we notice that he is powerful. And as you read in chapter 12 and in verse 4, it says his tail draweth the third part of the stars of heaven and is cast them to the earth, and the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child. Notice he is powerful. Look at what his tail can do. And you could read in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4 and Jude verse 6, he influenced angelic beings. Angels who sinned were cast into pits of darkness reserved to the day of judgment. Well, who caused them to sin? Satan did. He enticed them and he gained victory over them. Now, question here, have any of you ever walked down the sidewalk and been scared to death by somebody's dog that started Mickey, barking at you?
Mickey?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you posed a question back there. Wouldn't you say that, as an example, Satan did have a victory when he influenced Eve to sin?
He did, yes, but it was temporary. And we're going to talk about some of those short-lived victories.
But that's still a victory.
Yeah, but it was short-lived. He's not the ultimate victor.
No, but I don't think that was the point of your question.
No.
He did get a victory.
In the same way that he did with the angels.
Yeah, yes. because of that, sin came into the world.
That is true. But it's not the ultimate victory. I'm going to show you here just a little bit numerous temporary victories that he had. But there's always been a remnant that he did not gain the victory over. To my illustration about the dog scaring the living daylights out of you, we've got one at the end of the street that does that. When I was growing up, it wasn't uncommon to chain a dog. You ever do that? A lot of folks don't like to chain a dog. They want the dog to be in a pen or have the free roam of everything. I want to suggest to you that if you've got a vicious dog, you better chain him up or do something to restrain him. And that's the word that I want to use. I know we put a chain on a dog if he was vicious. And if you stayed outside the length of that chain, could he hurt you? Well, no. But did he have power? Oh, man, he could eat you for lunch, but only if you got in the circumference of that chain. Now, does that mean that the dog didn't have any power? Oh, he had lots of power. And how can you be delivered from the damage of the vicious dog? You stay outside the length of the chain. Isn't that simple? Now, is Satan given unlimited power? No, Christ has bound him. And we read that in Hebrews chapter 2. He's not given unlimited power. He's bound. Now, you want to be damaged by it? You go inside the perimeter of his chain and he'll eat you for lunch. But you stay outside that perimeter and all he can do is try to entice you to come in closer. And how many of us do it? And that's when we get in trouble. There's not deliverance inside there. But you stay on the outside and there is. Notice again, if you will, his appearance. 7 diadems. Not victorious crowns, Terry, but diadems. Now we notice that the only time I found this interesting that the term diadem is used is in the book of Revelation. And you'll notice here it's used in reference to the dragon. He had 7 of them on his head. The significance of the number 7, I think, is applied here. In chapter 13, verse 1, it's used regarding the beast out at the sea. He had 10 diadems on his 10 horns. But as we continue our study into the 19th chapter in verse 12, we're going to note that Christ, the rider of the white horse, had many diadems on his head. Now, what does that tell us about Christ? Well, this diadem is indicates a position of royalty. But Christ has many diadems. But what's promised to you? Here's the passage I was looking for in Revelation 3, verse 11. Those who overcome are promised not a diadem, but those who are overcome are promised a Stephanos. They're promised the victory crown. And this is what this woman wears in chapter 12, verse 1. Now you stay outside the circle, and what happens? You can overcome the devil. You can be faithful. You can serve the Lord. Now what's he doing, this dragon, the old serpent? He's waiting for the birth of the man child. Remember, we noted in Genesis 3:15, God put enmity between the woman and between the woman and her seed. Now, there have been many, many attempts to cut off the seed of woman. Well, we just mentioned a few. In 2 Kings chapter 11, anybody remember the king Josiah? When was he declared to be king? What can you tell me about King Josiah? What happened that almost got rid of the kingly lineage? Anybody remember? We studied this in our history and geography class. Well, turn back to 2 Kings and just gander that a little bit. 2 Kings chapter 11. In 2 Kings chapter 11, you read about an old wicked woman and her name was Athaliah. Those of you in our class remember that name. What was it that Athaliah wanted to do? She wanted to be king. She wanted to serve as the king. She wanted to be the queen of the nation of Israel. And so when you begin to look at the lineage, she usurped the throne. And as you read down further into that 11th chapter, you'll read about a certain priest whose name was Jehoiada. And he and his wife, they took young Josiah and hid young Josiah from Athaliah. And what was it that Athaliah did to usurp the throne of those of the lineage of David? What had she done to them?
She killed them.
She killed them. That's exactly what she did. She killed them all, she thought, except Josiah. And when this priest, Jehoiada, brought him out at the ripe old age of 8 years old and declared him to be king. Look at verse 13 and 14. And when Athaliah heard the noise of the guard and of the people, she came to the people, into the house of Jehovah. And she looked, and behold, the king stood by the pillar as the manner was. And the captains and the trumpets by the king and all the people of the land rejoiced and blew trumpets. Then Athaliah rent her clothes and cried, "Treason, treason." What'd they wind up doing with Athaliah? They killed her. That's right. But it came that close to destroying the lineage. If Josiah had been killed, there would not have been a kingly lineage. As you read in Isaiah chapter 1, verses 5 through verse 9, we're going to come back to this again. We want to note that the prophet Isaiah said, if it had not been for a very small remnant, we would have been like Sodom, we would have been like unto Gomorrah. All of God's people would have been destroyed. And the book of Esther, I won't ever forget my study with Penny Mills' grandmother, Florence Patterson. She wanted to know what the books of the Bible are about. And we just briefly went through the books. And when we got to the book of Esther, she was just like a kid sitting on the edge of her seat at 87 years old. Never read it before. And when we talked about Esther becoming queen and how that Esther, through the advice of Mordecai, had preserved the whole nation of Israel, she sat on the edge of her seat as I was telling the story and said, "And then what happened? And then what happened?" Well, it just came that close, just that close to destroying the whole nation. But because of Esther's efforts, we know that the people of Israel were permitted to arm themselves and defend themselves, and the nation was preserved. You think that was by accident? Now, from the historical perspective, we see a number of times, these are just a few, But a number of times when it would seem that the people of God were just going to be stamped out of existence, but there was always preserved a small remnant, always. Now, do you think when it would seem that the people of Israel were going to be stamped out of existence and the promise of God from Genesis 3:15 just was not going to ever happen, that old Satan sitting over in the corner just having a heyday, thinking, I got him now, I got him now. But it never worked, never, because a remnant was always preserved. Now, when you come into the New Testament, you'll note, well, Terry, to your point regarding victories of Satan, as it were, there were many in Israel that rejected God. They asked for Aaron to make them an idol, a god, to go before them. We see how that the people were interested in killing Joshua and Caleb in Numbers chapter 13, when only a few were being faithful. In Judges 2, most of them left. Stephen points that out in Acts chapter 7. But there was always this faithful remnant. We read about Joshua and Caleb. We read about this host of Old Testament worthies in Hebrews chapter 11. When you come into the New Testament, you read about Simeon and Anna in Luke chapter 2. They were serving the Lord. They were looking for the coming of the Christ. And in all through this period of time, Satan failed to destroy the chosen family from which the Messiah would come. And in the New Testament, he continued. When Jesus was born, what did he try to do even through Herod? To kill all the baby boys, because there's prophesied that a Messiah would come. He would be the king, and Herod ordered that all the little baby boys under certain age would be put to death. And Jesus and his family went down to Egypt past that period of time. And during the public ministry of Jesus, while he was preaching, what happened? Well, you notice time after time after time, the unbelieving Jews sought to put him to death. And finally, Jesus said that he would deliver up himself to be crucified. No man takes my life, but I lay it down and I will take it up again. And then on the cross, he said, it is finished. Now, question, when Jesus gave up the ghost on the cross, can't you just picture old Satan over in the corner rejoicing, said, I finally done it. I finally overcame. But what happened? Well, he didn't quite win anything, did he? Because that's where Hebrews 2 comes into our discussion again. In Hebrews chapter 2 and in verse 14. No, Satan did not gain the victory at all. But rather, Jesus was raised from the dead. And he that had the power of death was brought to nothing. Because now Jesus holds the keys of death and the keys of Hades. Now, in this next verse, we'll have to talk about it, I guess, next week. She was delivered of the son. The man-child came. And John writes, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne. When Jesus was raised from the dead, where did Peter say he went? Acts chapter 2. He was exalted at the right hand of God. He was taken up into the throne of God. So the man child came. Now, who's the man child? Well, we'll talk about that next week and talk about what he did. This chapter is so exciting in so many areas that we need to go in our study of this chapter, but I'll stop sharing. I'm out of time. And so we'll pause with that and start next time. Any comments or questions? I wish we had about a 3-hour block to go through this 12th chapter. It's just an exciting chapter. Yes, Dan?
Oh, yeah. I forgot to unmute. Oh. I was waving, but I wasn't speaking. Yeah. Anyway, that word, Satan, the God of this world, it brought me back to, I forget what scripture was, but Jesus himself said, referred to him as the God of this world. And that the word world is interesting because in the Greek it's cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just throw that in.
Appreciate it. Isn't this an exciting chapter?
Yes.
I think the next couple of chapters especially go with this, and it's going to be an exciting study if I can keep it moving. I appreciate your interest and your encouragement in this study. Yes, Bob.
No, it's Randy.
Randy, okay, got you.
You can call me Bob.
Okay, you're right next to Bob on my screen. Sorry.
Back in Micah 4, I just wanted to confirm or solidify in my head what you're talking about. Beginning in verse 6, Micah 4, verse 6, in that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather the outcasts, even those whom I have afflicted. I will make the lame a remnant and the outcasts a strong nation, and the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on and forever. So that's the beginning of the passage. And of course, you read down through 5,
3.
So this is, it's funny because as you were reading it, I was thinking, oh yeah, that you should have, long ago I highlighted Micah 5, 2 through 4.
Right.
Then I thought this whole thing is, it all goes together.
It so does.
The remnant then is the woman.
The daughter of Zion. Yeah. It's how it's used in our text to, speak of the redeemed all through. Like I said, it starts out being the faithful remnant of Israel, but then it encompasses the faithful of today, began on Pentecost.
So the daughter of Zion mentioned in verse 13 there, Micah 4, yeah. daughter of Zion, is the faithful remnant, and that's where the man-child came out of the faithful remnant.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you might back up, Randy. You said this goes together. I like to back it up even to the first of chapter 4, because we're well familiar with Isaiah 2, but Micah 4 says identically the same thing, but we seldom ever quote it from Micah chapter 4, but it's Isaiah 2, and then in verse 6, he says, in that day. Well, what day is he talking about? Same day that Isaiah 2 is talking about.
Yeah.
The Ancient of Days.
Okay.
Isn't that exciting?
It is. It's great.
Yeah, I like it.
It all fits together.
It does. I think it does. Yeah. Well, if there's no further questions or comments, let me say this, that we wouldn't close without extending to anybody that might be listening the opportunity to become a Christian. That's important to us. We want to help you in any way that we can to go to heaven. If you know that your life is not what it needs to be, and you know that there's a Savior, and that's what we're studying about, and that he died for you. You believe that's so, and you want to change the way you're thinking, the way you're living, confess your faith. We'll be happy to help you to be baptized this very hour for the remission of your sins. And if you've done that and you're not living a righteous life, and we can help you by praying with you and for you to that end, then that's our desire. We'd be delighted to do that. Just let some of us know.